I think some people think we know more than we actually do.
That's Marcelo Gleiser. He's also a physicist, but less certain than some of his colleagues that science has a main line to the truth. Steve Paulson got together with Gleiser recently to talk about his book, The Island of Knowledge: The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning.
Because science has been so successful over the last two centuries to explain so much about the natural world, yes, there is a seductive side of it, and some people call it scientism, which would basically mean that science is the only way to make sense of things. And that's where the danger lies, I think.
In what way is our knowledge limited?
Well, I think there are two ways in which we can immediately show that there are simply limitations in the way science actually works. So the first one is that in order to do science, you have to gather data about nature. So what we do is we amplify our senses with instruments. Just think of the microscope and you think of the telescope and what was happening before the invention of these two instruments and how they both transformed completely the way we think about the world. And you can even tell the history of science by telling the history of technological innovation, if you want, you know, how the two go hand in hand. However, we have to remember that instruments can only amplify our vision of nature up to a certain point. And we cannot see beyond that point. There is always going to be a blind spot, so to speak, things that we cannot see.
So you're saying that our knowledge is almost by definition limited to the technological instruments we use. I mean, we can't see beyond them, and we'll keep having new technologies that will reveal new things about the world, but we'll never get the whole picture.
Exactly. I think the whole idea that we can see everything or that our instruments can catch everything is just simply very naive. Just as a comparison, let's think about this for a second. So Galileo's telescope, which he didn't invent but that he used and perfected, he saw things that no one else had seen before, right? However, nowadays with, you know, garden variety telescopes that you can buy at Walmart, you can see these things too. And our most powerful telescopes can see remarkable stuff, right? They can go and see galaxies being born billions of light years away. But that does not mean that they can capture the whole story. So apart from the limitations from an instrumental perspective, you also have limitations, and these are really the tough ones. We have limitations that come from the way nature itself operates.
What do you mean?
For example, the speed of light. So light is incredibly fast, right? 186,000 miles per second. You blink your eye and light can go 7.5 times around the Earth. It's a ridiculously fast speed, you know, but it's not instantaneous, right? So if the sun exploded right now, it would take us about 8 minutes to find out. Granted, it would be the last thing you'd ever know, right? Boom, that's it. But the point is that everything that we see is in the past. Now, you combine this with the fact that the universe has a finite age, 13.8 billion years. That basically means that, you know, that's when time, as we know it, started to tick.
That's fascinating. I mean, you're suggesting then that we can only see the light that can travel over 13.8 billion years, but it's possible that the universe might be much bigger. It could be infinite, but we would never know because we don't have enough light to be able to see that far.
Exactly. So the point of this, which is kind of very fascinating, is that we could be fooled into believing that our view of the world is the real thing when it really isn't. So what really irks me is when we have like very famous scientists write books or make public pronouncements stating that we have solved some very fundamental questions about the universe, such as what is the Big Bang singularity or the theory of everything.
But the whole search for the theory of everything, that has propelled so many famous physicists in recent decades. I mean, that's the sort of the holy grail of physics for a lot of people, is to come up with an all-encompassing theory that will unite all of these sort of disparate parts of physics so everything works together.
Me included. I went into physics exactly for that reason. You know, I wanted to work on the theory of everything. I did my PhD on superstring theories, which is sort of the modern incarnation of this theory of everything. But, you know, with age and with experience, I came to realize that perhaps that is really not how you should be looking at nature.
You know, it strikes me that you are rather unusual for a physicist. You seem to have a deep philosophical streak. And there are a lot of physicists today who don't like philosophy at all. I mean, famous physicists like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss, Neil deGrasse Tyson,
right.
And they've all said very dismissive things about philosophy, basically that we don't need philosophy anymore because we have science. Science has replaced philosophy.
Right. And I think that's a big mistake. Not so much Neil deGrasse Tyson, but I think that what Hawking and Lawrence Krauss are saying shows how embarrassing it can be when a scientist does not know philosophy and starts to say things like that. What we are doing, you know, you cannot separate the technical aspects of physics, which is the mathematics, the concepts, from the philosophical conceptual structure of what physics is about. Whenever you split these two things, you become a technician. And when you deal with questions of the origin of the universe or the structure of matter and what is space and what is time, you just can't be a pure technician.
Well, I want to follow up on this, though, because you write about your early fascination with sort of the connection in particular between Eastern mysticism and quantum physics. And this is back when you were a graduate student in physics. And in fact, you were very taken by Fritjof Capra's best-selling book, The Tao of Physics, you know, this huge bestseller back in the 1970s, and you actually contacted him to see if you could work with him, and that did not work out. So there was something there for you.
Absolutely. I can say that I was a very, you know, I grew up in Rio, and in Brazil we have this syncretic combination of Christianity and the African religions. It's a very mystical place. And you see this in the streets every Monday morning, people like light candles on crossroads and black chickens, and then they put a cross in the middle of it. It's really weird how they combine the two things. But the point is that, yes, I grew up in this kind of environment, and I was very spiritual, and I was interested in Taoism and Eastern and yoga, etc., before I was interested in physics. So one day, after I started physics, I was walking around the library at my university in Rio, and I saw this book called The Tao of Physics, and it just blew me away. I was 18 years old. It was a driving notion for me for many years. And nowadays, however, I think very differently of the relationship between religions and science.
Are you religious at all today?
No, I'm not. But I'm also not an atheist. I call myself an agnostic, because basically what you're saying is that, look, I don't see any evidence of God or gods, but I cannot shoot it down because I don't have any evidence to the contrary.
Okay, so you call yourself an agnostic. You say that you are not religious anymore. Would you describe yourself as spiritual?
Absolutely. I think I'm a very spiritual person. And every time on Sundays when I go run my trails in the mountains here of New Hampshire, I think of people going to their temple, and I say, here I am going to my temple. Which is just being close to nature. So I think that a lot of the drive for me to be a scientist and to explore these fundamental questions of knowledge that we talked about here today comes from a very spiritual connection with nature.
Why do you call that spiritual? I mean, why not just say you're a scientist, you're trying to understand how the world works, that's what science is all about. What's spiritual about that?
Because I think that if you just say, I'm a scientist and I'm just trying to understand how the world works, you sound like you could be just a shoemaker, you know, and you could be just building shoes because I want to know how a shoe can work. There are different kinds of scientists. And I think I stand kind of in the middle as being a person that does not believe in supernatural causes in the universe, but on the other hand, believe in the beauty and sort of the mystery of our existence.
So given all that you have said about how science is inherently limited in some ways to our quest to understand reality, where does that leave us? I mean, what's a healthy response to how we should approach the world?
The healthy response is this, is that the fact that there are limits to knowledge should not be seen as the end of the story. It should be seen as the beginning of a new story. Because essentially, obstacles are opportunities for growth. So to me, identifying the limits of knowledge is actually a liberating experience, because we take off our shoulders the weight of carrying this truth with capital T, you know, which is really a burden So to me, identifying limits is actually the first step to transcending them.
That's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Marcelo Gleiser is a physicist at Dartmouth College. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Island of Knowledge: The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning.